So our final presentation for HIV 101 is Dr. Rafante, who is at Vanderbilt University in the Southeast AETC, talking about clinical manifestations of HIV, prevention, diagnosis, and management.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you all hear me? Cool. So my name's Steve Rafani. I'm sort of a high-volume HIV provider is what I do most of the time. And we're going to change gears a little bit now. I'm going to sort of talk again about what Dr. Sag, I forgot his last name, and Spock. Sorry, Mike. I forgot your last name. Talked about earlier, but I'm going to do it from the point of view of a clinician. And a good clinician's point of view should also be the point of view of the patient. So we're going to walk through some of this. I'll also say this is really HIV 101, so it's really something that I'm doing for novice and pre-novice treaters. So I have no financial affiliations. After attending the presentation, you should be able to understand a little more about the natural course of HIV-related disease and the principles of diagnosis of the more common clinical presentations and prevention of disease. And then we're going to talk a little about resources that are available. So, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be involved in this when HIV was first described and have taken care of patients since the early 80s. And those of us that have done it have seen and unfortunately had years and years and years and years of experience taking care of people whose underlying disease could not be treated. So we know what happens when you are not treated for HIV, and we know the clinical presentations. And if you think from 1981 to 1996, really, we didn't have great meds to treat HIV, and then everything changed. So what I'm going to be talking about today is those patients who've sort of fallen out of that, so not the well-managed patient that you're seeing every 6 months or every 12 months, and for fallen out of it or not are coming in late into care. But obviously, everything we're talking about at this conference is directed at preventing HIV-related disease, and the best way to prevent HIV-related disease is to treat HIV effectively. And the good news is that in our clinic, it's a large clinic in Nashville, we know that people coming into the system that we can engage, well over 90% will control their virus and pretty much live out their life. So we're going to spend a little time on this this graph, because we've heard about this sort of at a molecular and a cellular level, and now I'm going to talk to you about it from a patient's point of view. And we're going to start here, and I'm going to talk about a woman who, it's December 31st, 1989, and she lives in San Francisco, and she goes to the Fairmont to a New Year's Eve party, and she meets this really cool guy, and they have sex. And she wakes up January 1st, 1990, infected with HIV. Now, what she will go through, and we're just going to sort of do an average case scenario, is what is the result of the molecular and cellular process you've seen. And we know that somewhere by maybe mid-January, early February, she'll get ill, and she'll present in the way that those of you that do sort of general medicine, 20% of our patients present anyway, with fever, chills, not feeling well, maybe a sore throat, all the symptoms that Dr. Spock went over. And if she has access to health care, she'll go ahead and present herself. If she has sort of a sketchy network of health care, she may go to an ER. And if they see her in the ER, they'll evaluate her, and she'll mention she has a headache, and she's febrile, and she's a young person, she doesn't look that well. And they'll probably go ahead and scan her and get a spinal tap, and they'll see some cells in her CSF, and they'll tell her she has a meningitis, but it doesn't look like a bad meningitis. It's probably just aseptic meningitis or viral meningitis. And they'll be right in all that they've said. If they don't think of HIV, they'll miss that part. And then they may or may not admit her, depending on her insurance and where she is. And then they'll send her home after 2 or 3 days. Well, we've heard what's happening to her really is that she has turned into the most productive HIV-making machine that she will ever be. And in very short time, she'll do a couple things. She'll make an enormous amount of virus. And if you think, so we have 300 to 400 new patients a year at our clinic, and almost all of them are chronically infected, and they come in with viral loads between 50,000 and a couple hundred thousand. But the acutely infected has them measured in the millions. So she'll be making tons of virus, and she'll also be losing that lymphoid tissue in her gut that's so critical. And the way to think about this is, if you think of the human organism as being sort of a tube wrapped around the environment, and our gut is really just another external surface that deals with the environment, she's lost her first layer of immunity to everything that's out there. And so as she moves through these first few weeks, and it really is measured in weeks, and it's been shown really elegantly with these serial biopsies, she's lost that. And she's entering into this chronic inflammatory state that's been talked about that she'll never get out of. She may get better, but she'll never relieve this. So her immune system is constantly being pinged, and it's constantly seeing things that it shouldn't see and reacting to it. And by doing this, it's producing a lot of different chemicals, and a lot of them are toxic. And she's going to live in that toxic milieu for the rest of her life. And it's very important because, you know, we have great data on opportunistic infection. We have great data on how to predict, you know, who's at risk for what. But we don't have great data on what's it like to live in this inflammatory state even before you get treated for your HIV. What she'll notice is she'll get sick and she'll get better. And as far as I know, we don't have any good evidence of anyone dying of acute HIV. And in some ways, she will get to a set point. So a combination of how her genetic makeup and how her immune system interacts with the strain of virus that she's been infected with will come up with a set point of viral load, and then she will start her life living with untreated HIV. Now, you know, you can think of a couple things about her when she's acutely infected before she has this immune response and she somehow blunts this viral load. Just imagine if she were a young woman exchanging sex for cocaine, how effective that scenario would be for transmitting this virus, or if she were an injection drug user in East Tennessee. So, as mentioned before, this is a critical moment, not just in the disease, but in the epidemic. It's frustrating for those of us who treat people with HIV because we would have loved to have been there when they got infected and be able to impact that point. But what will probably happen to her is she'll go back to her baseline. She'll feel fine, maybe after. And we also know that the longer someone's sick with their acute disease, probably the more aggressive their disease is over time. So if someone's sick for 6 to 8 weeks, they're probably going to be one of those people that progresses very rapidly. But what will happen to her over time is she'll start not feeling as well as she could. So let's say she's a 24-year-old woman. By the time she's in her late 20s, she's probably not feeling as well as she should have at her age if she had not been infected with HIV. What's she going to notice? She might notice that her skin's not as healthy as it used to be, as dry. She gets a lot of sort of dermatitis. She may get recurrent vaginitis. She may get sore throats. She may just not feel as well. And as someone moves into sort of that mid-range, and I'm using as an example average amount of time from infection to developing AIDS, about 12 years. So we're going through that period. It really depends on what they do as a baseline to understand if they're going to notice what's happening. And I remember we had a woman a few years ago who had been infected for quite a while but didn't find out till her T count was under 200. And she was a pretty successful architect. And by the time we saw her, she was really making copies for her colleagues, you know, at the photocopy machine. And she really was not that upset about that, of course. And you think, well, how could someone so successful be so unaffected by their obvious decline in function? And the other thing that's going to happen to this woman and happen to that woman is over time she will develop neurocognitive disease. And we know that 50% of people with HIV have neurocognitive disease, even though some of that is asymptomatic and only be picked up with sort of testing. And then she may find out that as she goes over time, she'll become less socially interactive. She'll be withdrawn. Now, I always tell the house staff, if you don't ask people what they're doing, you won't know if it's okay or not. If a 28-year-old tells you, I'm fine, you have any complaints, and they say no, and you say, well, what do you do? When I come home from work, I go to bed, and on the weekends, I spend most of my time in bed because I'm so tired. That's not normal. When's the last time you've interacted with your friends and your family? These things you can tease out if you ask them, but people are not going to volunteer it, and it's not something that you're going to read about in a book. And then over time, sometime probably in the late, maybe the early 2000s, she'll get very ill. If you want to just roll the dice, you know, you can stay at home and sort of diagnose the majority of new presentations of AIDS, because most of them are going to be pneumocystis in this country. She'll get a fever, she'll get a cough, she'll go into the ER at San Francisco General, and they'll get a chest x-ray and put it up and say, oh, here's another person who's developed AIDS and has pneumocystis. That's sort of the whole course of what we're talking about now. And what I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about is how, as a clinician, do you sort of work with people who are at risk for anything from progression of disease to developing OIs. So this is a slide we used to go around in Tennessee in the early 90s, trying to talk to docs about HIV, and it's very simplistic. I mean, you know, it's one line, there's the CD4 count. But it's interesting that very early in the disease, it was obvious that dropping below 200 or 14% opened up this whole world of possibilities of bad complications. And everyone's familiar with this, and we know that there are different ones in different parts of the country that are different. But the bottom line is, this tool in your mind as a clinician is still very helpful, because you always have to be teasing out where someone sits on this curve when you're dealing with clinical complaints. So some people have broken it down into sort of formal periods, acute HIV we talked about, seroconversion somewhere up to 6 to 10 weeks, depending on what you're using to test, and then asymptomatic disease, 8 to 10 years, and then 2 to 4 years symptomatic with AIDS. So I still use the sort of the monitor of 12 to 14 years to develop AIDS from infection. So we're going to do some cases. Now, these cases are not highly technical. They're really an attempt to show you what seems to be important to me and to the patients, having done this a long time, and how you can sort of fit it into the scenario of caring for people, either before they start on therapy or when they've fallen off. So Rachel's a 22-year-old woman, and she's presenting to established care. She tested positive at a Hispanic health fair 3 months prior. She had never been tested before. She looks fine. Her labs are drawn, everything looked good, and those are her numbers. So she has a CD4 count over 600 and a viral load of 46,000. So here's her first question. Now, it's not always everyone's first question. There's actually a question they asked before this, but she wants to know, is she more likely to get sick now? That's actually a fairly big deal for people with HIV who are new to sort of dealing with their serostatus. So, your choices are, she's at increased risk to catch infections, her immune system's healthy, she's at no increased risk, she is relatively well immunologically, but is at increased risk for some infections, and she may be at risk for many of the AIDS-related illnesses, since we only have one CD4 count and don't know her current status. Good. Yeah, so the important thing here is that there are some things that she's going to be at increased risk for even while she's immunologically well. But one of the points of this when you're talking to the patient is to help them understand that they don't have to live a drastically different life. And in Nashville, which has become sort of overwhelmed with music events, you can be out in the crowd, you can go out and do things. Oh, that's weird. Yeah. So she's in the asymptomatic stage of HIV. Her virologic set point is set. It's going to be stable. It's hard to predict how people will decline over time in terms of their CD4 count. If you do just sort of a general thing, you can do 50 to 100 cells per year, but obviously it's a very different thing for someone who has a very high viral load as opposed to a very low viral load. But the point of that is a CD4 count from 3 months ago is fine. And she has risk for some infections. You know, her risk for TB is increased. and her, if she's exposed. She has a slightly higher risk of zoster. She also has a slightly higher risk of invasive pneumococcal disease. But for the most part, she's relatively well. So Jason's a 41-year-old man. He's diagnosed with HIV infection 4 years ago. He was initially started on antiretroviral therapy. He did well for a while, then he fell out of care. And he returned to reestablished care 4 months ago. He missed his follow-up appointment. And then at that time, 4 months ago, his T count was a little over 300, and his viral load was over 200,000. And now he calls the service complaining of increased fatigue, weight loss, and chills. He reports that he's feeling terrible. And we split call for our clinic three ways, and I can tell you that about half the calls at night, including the one I got last night, are from people who are out of care, not feeling well, and trying to reengage in care because they've finally been pushed to the point where their fear sort of overwhelms whatever other external barriers were keeping them from care. So he's calling you, and these are your options. You can have case management, contact the patient, set up an appointment, reestablish care, get back on heart. If we were to do that at our clinic, they'd come in and meet with a social worker, labs would be drawn, and they'd see a provider within a week or two. You could recommend the patient present to a walk-in clinic for evaluation. All I'll say about walk-in clinics is, unless you go there with a gunshot wound, you will leave with a Z-pack and Medrol dose packet, correct? So it's not just regional, it's not just Tennessee, good. Send the patient to the ED for an emergent workup of AIDS-related illnesses. Have the patient come into the clinic and evaluate clinically and repeat labs and follow up. Oh, shoot, I screwed you up. Sorry. There's just too many lights here, too many things moving at once. Good. That's good. That's a good clinical risk. That's what a clinician should say. So this, I think, is of all the things I do clinically, I think this is the most nuanced, is handling a symptomatic patient who may or may not be at risk. Everything that Jason complains of could be HIV, right? Every single thing could be just untreated HIV. But we really need to know a current CD4 count to determine what he's at risk for. And the way that we sort of sort through this is that if I know that his CD4 count is above 214%, then it's a very different clinical visit. And, you know, what would really happen in reality is I would have, it's like I told the patient Saturday night, unfortunately we weren't open today, but we're going to see him on Monday, and based on how well or poor he looks, we'll make a determination whether we can even wait for a CD4 count, right? Because he could come in and have a headache and a fever, and that would launch us in a whole different direction. But assuming I get a CD4 count, then my first goal is to reassure him that it's probably not something related to his HIV, and I'm going to sort of roll into the non-HIV general medicine evaluation. And I'm also going to incorporate into that how quickly we're going to get him back on therapy, how important it is, because now he was scared about possible HIV-related disease, and we're going to sort of use that and help him see how his life would be better if he didn't do that. If his CD4 count is under 200, then you have to be, I think, hypervigilant when you see him. That's not a 15-minute appointment. That's a 30- or 45-minute appointment, because you really have to prove to yourself that you're comfortable letting him go home pending some workup. And sometimes, I mean, we had a patient 2 weeks ago that we didn't think was that sick, and we actually sent to the ER right after we saw him, and he did have cryptococcal meningitis. But the only way we would have known that was by bringing him into the clinic. So there's this sort of role that you play as a clinician when you're taking care of people who are not effectively treated and well-controlled and healthy, and that's what we've talked about a little. Then there's another really important role that we play when we're managing people with HIV, and that's preventing disease. So in addition to keeping them healthy, we want to make sure that they have the appropriate prophylaxis and vaccinations that are essential. So Anthony's a 44-year-old male construction worker living in Memphis, now enrolling in care. He was diagnosed 6 years ago, had been on meds in the past, but none for about 2 years. He feels well with no specific complaints. Labs reveal a CD4 count of 134, 8%. viral load of over 300,000, Hep A serology positive, anti-Hep B serology positive, and core positive and toxo positive. So, what are you going to do? Start prophylaxis for PCP and MAC, for PCP histo, all of the above, plus CMV and PCP only. Good. So 9% of you thought this was a trick question, I suspect. Right? How many of you knew that Memphis is sort of in the histo valley? Good. It is, but it's not at the level of cases. I think you're supposed to prophylax histo if it's under 150, and they have 10 cases per 100 patient years of life, which Memphis actually doesn't qualify for. I didn't mention toxo. How many people, you can raise your hands, how many people would have prophylaxed him for toxo? He's serology positive. Well, you would have when you prophylaxed him for PCP, so that was a trick question too. So it's true. You want to start this. It's according to guidelines. It's not rocket science, but it's incredibly important. Because if you don't prophylax him, he probably will develop pneumocystis sometime in the future, right? So, assuming no history of adult immunizations and no significant dry allergies, what would you do? Initiate vaccination schedule to include all of those. Defer until his immune reconstitution is above 200 cells per cubic millimeter. Initiate vaccination schedule at Hep A and one dose Hep B. And vaccinate for Hep A, defer others until immune reconstitution. Okay. Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I think the sort of the take-home is there's, especially when you're getting someone back into care who's going to go on therapy and we assume is going to respond very well and reconstitute fairly quickly because he's relatively young, I think it's okay to defer. I think the only thing I would have done differently, if he had been Hep A negative, I probably would have given him the first dose because Tennessee, Kentucky, and California are in the midst of a pretty gnarly Hep A epidemic. But yeah, other than that, I think most of us would defer. Oh, can I go back one? I can. And just, these would be wrong. So he's Hep A positive, so he doesn't need that. One dose Hep B, it's hard to know. I think he was core antibody positive, so there's a lot of controversy about what you do with that. Most of us would initiate a whole course of therapy. And this would be wrong because he's Hep A positive as well. So this is sort of a resource slide. Recommendations for prevention of first episodes of OIs are specific to the HIV disease stage, prior vaccination status, and geographic location. The recs are very, very good, and those of you that don't sort of have quick access to this, it's a good tool to use. And I still use it and refer to it a lot with trainees in terms of what the recommendations are for starting, for stopping, for secondary, for maintenance therapy. And it's hard to keep track of. And a lot of times it's useful to know the exact number cutoffs. For example, how long does someone have to be successfully treated for disseminated MAC before you can pull off their secondary prophylaxis? This is sort of a cheat sheet. We have a number of these in the clinic. Excuse me. But again, something you should be familiar with, even if you're only caring for a handful of patients, the prophylaxis issue is one of the worst sort of errors to make as a clinician if someone does get a disease that you could have prevented. Some of these are pretty complicated, though, I have to admit. And then when you get into sort of the more exotic diseases, it can get sort of difficult. So If you think about what we do when we see patients come into care and patients who can come to the clinic on a regular basis and sort of we're going to develop a relationship with, the key here and sort of what you could get from the prior two talks is there's not a shortage of effective medications. You know, a lot of times when I give talks to the general house staff and sort of our practice transformation clinics, people are surprised to find out there's really not a problem with active drugs. There's not a shortage of good drugs. The problems come up when people are not effectively linked to care. So when we see people at the clinic for our first visit, you know, they've already seen the social worker, sort of had a little mini AIDS and HIV 101. All their labs have been drawn. We have those results in hand. But we really spend an enormous amount of time talking to the patient and getting a few messages across. And you know, if there's only one thing you remember from this talk, I strongly recommend that everyone come into care now, unless they're extremely ill with, you know, low CD4 count. The message I always tell them, I reiterate right before they leave, I always say, okay, what did you learn from today? The message is this won't shorten your life. That's a huge message for people. And it's still, I mean, it's amazing to see when you say that to them, especially if they're there with their loved one, you know, a family member or a partner, how that sort of releases them from a whole level of expectations they have. And the other thing that I sort of try to instill in them is how important it is to feel comfortable with where they are so they can access the clinic, to make sure that we do a good job taking care of them, that we're sort of working together towards one goal, and that they don't have to live a dramatically different life. And I mean, it used to be, well, it's going to have this huge impact on your intimate life, but now we know with U equals U that it's not as great as we thought. There is almost no profession you cannot do because of your HIV status. And so we go and talk about that a lot. And then we sort of focus on what would be the most important point for retaining them in care. At our clinic, we do not do rapid initiation of antiretroviral therapy because we have sort of a system set up that can sort of move people through the system to where they'll actually see a provider in 2 weeks and be started on care. What's been incredibly important in terms of keeping people in care is we have an intake navigator who's a social worker whose only job is to follow the new patients through time to make sure that it's a good fit with the clinic. And then most recently, we found out that we have to do a very personalized approach to missed appointments because our no-show rate is about 22%, and we're trying to drop that down to 15%. All these things are critically important. They're as important as everything else you're going to hear about in the conference in the next day or two, because everything that you're being exposed to here, the idea is you're going to take back to your sites, you're going to help train and educate your colleagues, but it all boils down to how you all interact with the patient in the clinical setting. That's what makes this work. And even though the meds are great and, you know, things are so successful when it works, it still doesn't work for everyone, and it doesn't work for people who are not well integrated into their care. Good resources. You've seen the HIV curriculum. I would strongly recommend you to get up close and personal with your local AETC. We're there to help train and do anything we can to make things work for your clinical site. And then I would always refer back to the guidelines, which I think are a great teaching tool as well as keeping your practice online. I think I'm on time.
Great, thank you. You did a great job covering everything about HIV care. So do we have any questions? Yes.
Hi, Steve. That was great. Really nice to kind of get the whole perspective on taking care of new patients. You mentioned in your final recommendations they're just urine GCCT testing. Do you guys usually do three-site testing?
Yeah, that's actually a great question because I think After making sure that everyone tells people their lives are not going to be shortened, the next most important thing is screen for STIs. You know, 50% of people don't have symptoms for GC or chlamydia. We screen every time, every orifice, if appropriate. I can tell you, if you're not doing that and you start doing it, it's going to change your whole world in terms of calling people with positive test results, which is what I do every Friday afternoon. It's Syphilis Friday. It is. Hi, my name is Steve, and you have syphilis.
Hi, can you talk just a little bit about what your initial patient navigation involves, and then what your follow-up of no-show appointments involves?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we have sort of two tiers for that. Our regular patient navigator is really an intake coordinator, a social worker, whose her only job is the new patients. We have about 30 to 40 a month. And she will do sometimes daily phone calls until they come in. And then she'll actually, it's sort of nice. What we found out is, I know this is going to shock everyone, but not all patients like all providers. You know, it turns out some people like a type of provider that we can't always predict. And so sometimes the patient intake coordinator will actually call back, so I see you saw Dr. Refine, how'd that go? And they'll say, well, I don't really like him. I really like a female, or I like a younger person. And then they are sort of in charge of making sure, independent of all our other structures, of making sure that for the first six months, that patient continues to follow up. We have a second tier where we have a pathways clinic where people have such extreme external barriers, they can't come in. And we actually have a caseworker that meets them in the community. We can have blood drawn in the community if we have to. That's an extreme case, and we have about 60 patients in that program. Our no-show thing, we keep trying new things. We're now having the providers actually contact the patients after they don't show and make it more personalized. It's very hard, I can tell you. I don't think we're going to be able to get below 15% no-show rate. Life's just too complicated.
Thank you. My question was, I couldn't tell whether you were suggesting you monitor hepatitis B surface antibody or varicella zoster antibody in patients over time, and whether or not you do anything about it if they lose their seropositivity.
Yeah, so what we've done is we've sort of changed our policy in terms of monitoring. You're talking about monitoring serologic response. Yeah, so with the Hep A epidemic, two things happened to us. We were in the middle of this huge Hep A epidemic, and then our electronic medical record changed again, which means that we have to forget everything we ever knew about the patient unless we want to take a day off and look for it. And so what it did is it actually made us just repeat all the Hep A and Hep B serologies. I was sort of surprised at the number of people who had lost immunity to Hep A, not so much Hep B. We have not been very aggressive about zoster because in our payer mix, it's hard to get the vaccine paid for. So we've sort of been farming that out to pharmacies and doing it, you know, it doesn't really matter whether you are or not. We go ahead and make the recommendation for 60 and above, but ask them to do it. The pharmacy can actually screen to see how much money out of pocket they have to pay. That's been hugely problematic for us. Yes, yeah, so I'm talking about the recombinant vaccine Shingrix, which seems, you know, it's not a perfect study, but it seems to be very safe in people with HIV. It should be as effective or more effective than the old vaccine. And like I said, the problem is, in fact, I just had a meeting Friday where we had six people have their insurance company reject the ones we gave, reject payment on the ones we gave on site.
Before we go to the floor, another question just about immune reconstitution and vaccinations and waiting until someone's CD4 count is 200. Like, how long do you wait? Like, some people are never going to get there, and how do you make those decisions?
Yeah, so the majority of people will get there fairly quickly. I find it extremely age-related. You know, there's not a huge urgency to most of these vaccines, so I think, you know, I plan to get everything rolling within 6 months. With the exception of Hep A, and we're giving everyone that the first time, regardless. I don't worry too much about IRIS. I worry about IRIS separately, but it doesn't really impact on what I do in terms of vaccinations. I have a lot of older men who have never gotten above 200, and I've done all their vaccinations. You know, now, if you ask me, did they respond, I would be embarrassed to tell you I'm not 100% sure.
Hi. I noticed that twice you talked about having enough time to talk to somebody, kind of one when they're really sick and you're trying to sort out whether they have an opportunistic illness. And the other time was, you know, just when you first meet a patient. And I've been doing care, I guess, at the David Powell in Austin for about 20 plus years. And I've always found that to be true, that if I have enough time, I can sort of hopefully establish some sort of rapport that will allow them to trust me enough to take some meds and come back.
Yes.
And, you know, what I've also noticed is that frequently, you know, throughout the years, we've had to advocate for having enough time to actually talk to people. I was wondering if you'd experienced that also, just constantly trying to say, no, we need more time to really take care of folks. And also, if you were aware of any evidence basis for that, because I certainly, you know, I have a certain confirmation bias to where I feel like if I could take a better history and answer enough questions, that someone's going to come back and see me.
Yeah, so I think the question is really about, we both agree on the importance of time, right, to make that link?
Yes.
And then the pressures we have. So I work at Vanderbilt. I'm RVU-based. I don't know if you all know what that means. And I have a one-hour new patient appointment. I have 15-minute follow-ups. I see 24 people a day when I don't have new patients. And that's inadequate. So I go late, and I run through lunch, and I don't know how to fix that. I do know that a successful new patient appointment ends with me sitting there and saying, so do you have any other questions? Do you know what I mean? That moment where there's just nothing left to do, and you can just sit there. And that, to me, over the years, has become, if I can't do that, if I'm still doing something at the end of that hour, I think that's almost a failed encounter. I wish I could redesign things so it could be done differently, but I don't know how to do that. But I agree with you 100%. And it really is, it amazes me how, you know, because we have a lot of fellows trained through our clinic, and it's so interesting to see the ones that make a good connection with the patient and the ones that don't. And I think I can tell within 30 seconds of seeing the interaction whether that's going to go. And it has to do with them sensing that you care and you have time and you're going to listen to them. Which is what I want when I go see the doctor. I mean, it's nothing different than anyone else. But I agree with you. And I don't know how to fix that pressure, and I don't think that's going to get better in the future.
Are you aware of any... Thank you. Are you aware of any evidence basis for time spent with patients, especially HIV patients?
No. I'm more aware of the thing about, you know, what comes out is whether the patient thinks that the provider cares about their outcome and whether the patient thinks the provider has enough time for them, but I don't know other than that.
Thank you.
Carlos.
Great talk, Steve. Inflammation is a major issue in the treatment of HIV, and one of the major problems with inflammation is the severe depletion of the lymphoid tissue in the gut. From the clinical point of view, on your experience, do you see clinical manifestations are different, for instance, in somebody who acquired HIV, for instance, a man having sex with men with significant rectal exposure versus somebody who was an IV drug user?
Well, I think one thing, the depletion of the gut lymphoid tissue probably long-term affects how the patient feels and what goes on, obviously, in inflammation. I can't think of any short-term clinical manifestations. But when you start talking about risk factor and what we see clinically, obviously the injection drug user is a very different risk category than someone who's having receptive anal intercourse. We certainly see different STD patterns. For one, but I can't think of really anything related to the loss of lymphoid tissue in the gut that would sort of trigger me.
Good morning. You mentioned that you've noticed a lot of your hepatitis A patients have lost their antibodies.
Not a lot, but more than I expected.
Okay. Is this something that y'all were checking due to the outbreaks, or is it something that y'all randomly reached?
Yeah, this is directly related to the outbreak. So we had assumed, I had assumed that, you know, if they're hep A immune 8 years ago, they're hep A immune. It turns out, and I couldn't really find good data on this, it turns out that's not always true. So it's definitely because of this epidemic. We've actually had three people come in for their initial labs, you know, just new patients, who had acute hep A and didn't even know it.
Okay. Have y'all been checking the hepatitis B as well?
Hepatitis B has waned over time, but I think people knew that about hep B. I think it was news to me about hep A.
And another question, with the hepatitis B, since we know that they wean over time, is that something that y'all recheck randomly or no?
I think we're going to now, yeah. I just don't know the interval. I'm going to try to figure it out.
Yeah, so a couple questions, just really quick question and answer. Can you use the viral load so you have a sense of how acute their infection is based on viral load alone?
Yes, so I would highly caution you about trying to predict when someone got infected, because every time people have asked me that, there was a reason for it. I don't want to be testifying. But really, I mean, I tell people, gee, you know, that's why we always ask, have you ever been tested before? And if they have been, it was negative, we're just going to give them a ballpark. And the other thing, we try to find out if they ever had something that could have been acute HIV, but I would really shy away from saying, I think you got it in, you know, 1997. The guy said, I knew that guy.
So HPV vaccine in people over 40?
Yeah. So HPV vaccine has just recently been approved up to age 45. We were very successful doing it in all our patients under 26, and now we're marching forward and doing it up to under 45. I think very soon it's going to be everyone, but yeah, I strongly recommend it. You know, in our patient population, after lung cancer, the second cancer cause mortality is anal cancer. It's a horrible disease.
Questions. This is from a person that's been in for a long time. This is older data. That flu vaccine could cause a blip in the viral load, and is that true, and how does that affect how you give flu vaccine versus checking viral load?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's true. I think there are people who know the data better, but I thought when they went back and looked at that, it wasn't so much if your virus is controlled. I don't think someone who's on, you know, integrase inhibitor or protease inhibitor-based therapy and gets a flu shot, it's going to matter much. We start as soon as we get it in our hands, and we continue until we no longer have the vaccine.
And what are the indications for latent TB infection treatment in someone with HIV?
That was not on the agenda. That's why those guidelines are so good, because people like me would go. I don't really know the specifics of that. I would strongly recommend you look at the guidelines, which is what I would do.
I'm very interested in the Gardasil vaccine in that 26 and up age group. This is an FQHC. I'm seeing you're going, how are we going to pay for this? Are they paying for it?
Yeah, so far we have not had a lot of pushback. Now, we were lucky.
With Medicaid?
So we have an odd payer mix in our clinic. We have... So we were in a Medicaid blockade state, so it was not expanded. So... our patients who normally would have gotten Medicaid actually get a ACA plan that Ryan White pays for. So I have very few pure Medicaid patients.
So Ryan White.
Yeah, Ryan White will pay for it in our state.
Thank you so much.
So do you have a systematic approach of catching new patients in the ER and getting them into clinic? How does that work for you guys?
So we have a... The way it works in Tennessee, I can only speak to Tennessee, and it's most of the state, is that there is a network of centers of excellence. There's 11 of them across the state. And all the sites that do testing, whether it's a community-based organization or an ER or a health department, have those sites. And when someone tests positive, they're actually given the information about their sites. And in most areas, including ERs and health departments and CBOs, they're actually allowed to make the appointment with our intake coordinator at that time. It's not a perfect system because obviously there's weekends, nights, all that stuff, but sort of it picks up 70-75% of the new diagnoses.
Okay. With that, we're going to conclude the morning session. We're going to start at 11 o'clock with the launch of the overall clinical conference. So thank you all. Thank you for participating.